This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 101 was recorded January 18th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Bloomberg market strategist Mark Cudmore will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. Mark and I will go around the world of macro, discussing everything from the U.S. dollar to China to Europe, along with global trends in both fixed income yields, as well as both emerging and developed equity markets. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will tell you about a webinar on the subject of trading the ratio call spread strategy, which will be completely free for Macro Voices listeners.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 pushed to an all-time new high earlier this week before giving a little bit back today. What's your thinking here on the S&P 500?
Well, boy, you know, finally a little bit of volatility. We had that 1% down day on Tuesday just before taping the interview, actually, with Mark Cudmore. And I should have been putting on the ratio call spread that we've talked about so much. Instead, I was on the phone to you saying, hey, Patrick, we ought to cover the ratio call spread. And I think in the time we were on the phone, or at least it felt that way almost, we saw the beginning of a retrace that ended up going to 100%. Maybe we're selling off again, but I do think that it's basically the same picture we've talked about before. Of course, this market is overvalued and could crash sometime, but I don't think it's likely to. I think that we're really just at the beginning of the crazy phase of the end of bull markets, where emotion takes over, logic goes out the window, and you see a melt-up. Certainly, we're at a very technically overbought condition right now. The last few days have printed overbought on a technical level, so we're due for some kind of pullback. I don't think it's the beginning of the end, though. I think it's if we get a pullback of a couple of percent here, I think that it may be an opportune time to talk about that ratio call spread trade. We're going to do extended coverage of that in postgame because so many people have asked about it. So I'll save that topic for later discussion.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because just the other day we had this quick little short-term reversal up in the dollar index, and today it gave it all back. It's like the U.S. dollar index can't seem to catch a bid and hold it. What's your thinking? Do we go a little bit lower still here?
Yeah, you know, the downside break below that 91 key support level, it seems pretty darn clear now that it's real. You know, the odds of it being a false breakout or just a temporary thing or whatever, you know, it seems like we got a pretty strong break here. Big question in my mind, does that necessarily mean that this is the big one that Luke Groman and Mark Yusko have talked about, where this move in the dollar is really the beginning of a long-term end game for the dollar? Or is this just a trade? We'll go down to the next logical, you know, support levels, probably 88 or so. Is it going to turn around at that point? I'm not all the way to persuaded that the world is slowly coming to an end, but I do think that the way these events have transpired, you know, all indications are a weakening dollar. And a lot of the factors that I thought would cause a reversal never happened. So I'm going to continue to watch this carefully. Next logical support, if you were expecting this thing to bottom and turn around, would probably be around 88 or so. I think there's another level just below it, around 87.5. You know, we'll see what happens when we get there.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude approached that 65 on the upper end, and since then it's been consolidating for the remainder of the week, and we're trading now just below the 64 handle right now. What's your thinking here on crude?
You know, the market's been struggling going into inventory. It seemed like it really wanted to correct to the downside. We'd taken out the 5 and 8 day moving averages on an intraday basis this morning. But of course, then came inventory, and inventory was delayed by a day this week. It came Thursday at 11 a.m. instead of the usual Wednesday due to the holiday. We saw a 6.9 million barrel massive drawdown on inventory. That's the national number. over Cushing, Oklahoma, which of course is critical for the West Texas Intermediate Crude Oil Futures Contract, drawing down an unheard of 4.2 million barrels. Now, for Cushing, Oklahoma alone, 4.2 million barrels, that's just a massive drawdown. I believe that's the second biggest drawdown in the history that I have anyway. I don't have history for this series going back before the 90s, but certainly for the last 15 years, that's either the biggest or the second biggest Cushing drawdown in a single week. Gasoline building 3.6 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 3.9 million barrels. So distillate drawdown more than making up for the gasoline build. Finished products basically a wash. Massive, massive crude oil drawdowns. Obviously, that's got to be super bullish. Well, guess what? It was super bullish for like an hour, and then it rolled back over again. And what it really says to me, Patrick, is this market, it's not looking for an excuse to go higher. It's looking for an excuse to go lower. We did manage to eke out a close just barely above those short-term moving averages. Normally, I would say, okay, traded below the short-term moving averages intraday, but closed above them. Maybe there's still some upside left. Maybe there's one more wave up in this move before it rolls over. But, you know, in the face of that really, really bullish inventory print, not seeing any follow-through, and it's already retracing back down. And then after the close this afternoon, we saw a continued sell-off. Everything says to me this market is tired and ready to roll over. I think maybe what we're waiting for is to see Friday's rig count print in terms of that maybe being the catalyst, if it is a big number, which I expect it may be, to allow this market to roll over. On the other hand, production is back up 258,000 barrels. That sounds like a massive increase. But remember, last week we had a 290,000 barrel decline in U.S. production. I said at the time that I thought it was an anomaly that was not going to last. Sure enough, we got it all back this week, or almost all of it. So I think that was an anomaly. This big increase in production is not really an increase. It's just wiping out what was probably an erroneous number last week, getting back to where we started 2 weeks ago. 1 week, in any case, doesn't make a trend. I do think that we're on the cusp of a reversal to the downside. This market is technically overbought. The big question is it a correction or a trend change? Are we going to see a multi-month sell-off as we had begin in February of last year? Or is this just going to be a short correction of a week or so down to, let's say, low 60s and then head back up again? We'll see what happens. I think the rig count is going to help us decide. Got quite a few tweets and emails congratulating me on being right last week. I appreciate the flattery, but I haven't really been proven right yet. What I predicted last week was a trend of increasing rig count numbers. We did see one, a significant one, last Friday, but that's just one weekly print. Let's see if this actually turns into a trend. I think it will. The reason I say that is based on a three-month lag of WTI prices. I expect the rig count to pick up considerably in coming weeks, and I think that should help a sell-off to occur. But, you know, it's going to depend. If we don't see the rig count pick up right away, if we get more bullish news flow, maybe there's another wave up to 67, 68 before this rolls over. I definitely think if you look at just how incredibly extreme sentiment has become, there's an 11 to 1 ratio now of speculative longs to speculative shorts. When this thing does roll over and nothing goes up in a straight line, it's going to be extremely vulnerable to an accelerated sell-off. Is that massively, you know, everybody on one side of the boat, when they start to jump ship, it gets ugly fast. And I think that's coming. Whether we're upon it right away in the next few days remains to be seen.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold has been responding incredibly well to the U.S. dollar over the last month or more, and we've had this nice push up toward 1345, but we've now had 2 days of a little bit of selling, giving back almost $20 an ounce. What's your thinking here on gold?
I am perplexed, Patrick. I just have to admit it straight up. My anticipation was that when we saw this dollar breakdown below 91, I thought you would see an acceleration of the move down in the dollar, and we've got that. And I thought it would lead to a dramatic move up in the price of gold, as everybody says, okay, the direction is clear on the dollar. let's all pile into gold. We're seeing the dollar index play out exactly as I expected. And if anything, right around the time that that news came out, gold kind of peaked right around 1340, and it's selling off. Not massively, but it's selling off. I was not expecting this, and you know, I guess all I can say is I don't really have a good explanation for it. What we need to see in order to indicate that a bull move is really on is a new closing print above of the previous high back in September, which was around 1358 or so. I thought we were going to get there very quickly, Patrick, and we haven't, and I don't have a good explanation.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury, because I wanted to really ask you about this. I mean, we're a stone's throw away from the January highs right near that 265 yield on the 10-year. What's your thinking here? Do we hit that overhead resistance or do we blow through it?
I think that's exactly the right question to ask. I don't have an answer other than to say I'm watching very closely. We're at this point now. I think 264 was the previous high closing print in yield. We're hit 261 at least intraday today. I didn't see what the closing number was. We're definitely past that 260 level, which I think Jeff Gundlach said was going to be the line in the sand. Now, we've only been there for a day. Maybe it's a false move and a head fake. You know, we'll see. But if this is sustained, if we move above 260 on the 10-year and stay there for at least a week, maybe it says that that trend that we've been waiting for really is in play and it's to the upside. Now, I don't think we can go way upside the way some people are saying. You know, a return to what we would think of, let's call it old normal treasury yields, 5 or 6, 7% on the 10-year. That would bankrupt the U.S. government. There's no way that we could service our debt. So I think as Lacey Hunt has articulated such a good argument, there is so much debt in the world that we're stuck with generally low treasury yields for many years to come. They're getting short-term higher in the face of generally low, and it seems to be accelerating. So I've been waiting for a trend to establish. Certainly, if we go past 265 and this continues to go on, it's going to be very interesting to see how far it can go. And you know, the thing that really is going to be interesting to watch, Patrick, is this increase in treasury yields to the extent that it enables at the same time, which is what it's happening here, an improvement in differentials compared to other sovereigns around the world. That should be drawing capital flows into the dollar, and that should be arresting this dollar index drop. So if the dollar index continues to drop, even as treasury yields continue to actually advance in a trend, not just for a couple of days, but if we're looking at 270, 280, 290, 3% yields on the 10-year and the dollar index is still dropping, that's one of those major signposts that we talked about in the dollar endgame series for what to watch for that would tell you that the endgame is on. I don't think we're there yet. I think this has to resolve one way or the other to where either the dollar turns around or treasury yields turn around. I can't see us getting to much higher treasury yields without it affecting international capital flows.
Well, thanks for the summary there, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview guest, we have Mark Cudmore, a macro strategist who runs the Markets Live blogging team in Asia for Bloomberg. Eric's interview with Mark is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Mark Cudmore, who heads up the Markets Live blogging team in Asia for Bloomberg. Mark, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've got a really busy schedule. I want to start with the U.S. dollar because obviously it's so dependent, everything is on it. But particularly in the last week, we finally saw this resolution of a new lower low below the 91 prior print on the dollar index. So is this just a little trade, or are we looking at a major secular trend? I think you've actually been bearish on the dollar for, you know, quite a long time before it suddenly became in vogue recently. Give us a little bit of history of why you've had that view and what you see coming from here.
Yeah, thanks. Hi. I think this year it's kind of a mirror image of 12 months ago when I really became very kind of structurally bearish the dollar. And just to kind of give some context of why that change happened then, first of all, I think that the market was extremely bulled up. And I mean, that's the opposite of this year where everyone's quite negative. But they were also very kind of bullish on a slightly suspect framework. And there was this whole narrative that there was this going to be this global reflation trade led by the U.S. And actually what happened in 2017 2017 is the U.S. was very much middle of the pack in terms of growth amongst the G10 economies. It wasn't one of the leaders at all. And also, there was the fact that the U.S. 12 months ago still had very negative real yields most of the way out the curve. And yet there was this narrative that because hikes were coming, they were going to have, you know, this real yield support. But that just wasn't there. Suddenly now, we've had quite a bit of a change in the U.S. So this year, 2018, based on consensus forecasts, not anything like out of the ordinary, it is expected that U.S. will be one of the fastest growing developed market economies. So amongst the G10, it will be only beaten by Australia and New Zealand based on consensus forecasts. So suddenly the U.S. is leading developed market growth this year, and yet people are much more bearish. On top of that, we've had like a 70 basis point climb in two-year yields in the last 4 months. So suddenly that massive negative real yield you had in the U.S. has kind of disappeared. So both the rates argument and the growth argument are much more supportive for the dollar this year than 12 months ago, and yet the kind of positioning and sentiment has switched massively. Now, I should say that this is kind of making me feel that the dollar is vulnerable to probably a sustainable bounce that could last several weeks, several months. But I think overall, structurally, in the much more longer term, I do kind of stick by my call from January last year that the dollar is in a multi-year downtrend. And I think, you know, the background picture here is that the dollar still makes up roughly 63.5% of global reserves, and yet the U.S. economy is a slowly shrinking part of the global economy. It's currently about 24.5%. Now, the U.S. is the world's reserve currency. It's always going to retain a premium in terms of its large financial markets, but that premium is going to shrink more and more. So the fact that it's still 63.5% of reserves seems too high. So I think structurally, the world is still long dollars and will slowly start trimming that position, and that's going to be a headwind for the dollar. But for the next couple of months, I think people are maybe over their skis and being bearish, and I think there's a chance of a bounce. And that's kind of the dynamic I'm looking at the moment.
Now, something we've discussed quite a bit on this program is a very interesting signal, which is we're seeing actually a lot of expectations of more rate hikes from the Fed. You would think in the face of increasing interest rate differentials, you know, traditional macroeconomic theory says that attracts international capital. There should be flows into the dollar. But we're seeing the dollar weakening even as rate differentials are improving. And some of our guests have suggested that maybe it doesn't necessarily mean the dollar loses its reserve currency status entirely, but maybe this de-dollarization trend that Russia and China have talked about is starting to gain a little bit of traction. Do you think that there's room for that interpretation based on what we're seeing, or is it just a case of maybe those rate differentials haven't kicked in yet and we're going to see the dollar recover as we do start to see those rate hikes come in the future?
I think it's the opposite, actually, that they haven't kicked in yet. I think the dollar benefited in advance. So the Bloomberg Dollar Index, you know, the kind of broad trade-weighted index, rallied more than 25% between mid-2014 and early 2017. So basically, when there was only two rate hikes, we saw 25% increase in the dollar in a trade-weighted index. So that's because FX markets tend to front-run the expectation of the rate hiking cycle. And this rate hike cycle was very much kind of forecast, it was expected, it was predicted. And in fact, it kind of came through slowly, lower than expected. So what we saw is actually the FX already made that massive appreciation. And this is why we kind of saw the dynamic last year that even though the Europe has done very little to kind of withdraw stimulus, they've done a small bit of kind of tapering and some signaling, but still they've got negative yields. We've seen the euro benefit. And that's because FX markets drive it ahead. And I think people who kind of get very excited about the fact that there was rate hikes in 2017 and go, why the dollar rallying, are not really looking at history. We kind of generally see this in US rate hiking cycles. We quite often see the dollar trades poorly. And that's because when you have the U.S. rate hiking cycle, that implies the U.S. economy is doing well. When the U.S. economy is doing well, because it's still the world's largest economy, that means the global economy is doing well. And at that stage of the process, we're actually in a re-leveraging period. And that means people are pouring into assets in other parts of the world. And that generally means selling down the world's reserve currency, selling down the dollar. So this is actually quite a normal cycle. Currencies front run the expectation of the rates move. And it's not like the rate hikes last year were a surprise.
Now, you're in Asia, which gives you the benefit of actually knowing about markets. Something I've noticed is there's a lot of people in the United States talking about this new Shanghai Futures Exchange contract that was supposed to start trading this week. It has now been delayed by a couple of months. A lot of people who have never been to Asia and probably don't know as much as you do about the markets are speculating about what that may mean for the U.S. dollar. Some people think it's just a sideshow. It has absolutely no significance. Other people are saying, hey, if this thing gains traction, contraction, it could seriously derail the petrodollar system and the dollar's role as the hegemonic currency in the world. What do you think there in Asia about this new oil contract that would be yuan denominated? Is it a serious factor or is it a sideshow?
I think the answer is going to be slightly nuanced. It's really a massive factor. I think it's very big, but it's not going to be a sudden event. I think this is another step in the process of the dollar's kind of dominance of world trade, world commodity pricing is being slightly eroded at the margin. But this is not going to be a sudden thing. The dollar will remain the world's reserve currency for a number of years to come. There's just no viable alternative. It's just that its complete share of global trading will continue to be eroded. And that's another step in this process. I think it is also important about how successful China managed to make this whole oil contract. And I think this may tie in with the, you know, some people speculate this may tie in with the Saudi Aramco IPO, that maybe they can exchange some kind of support there from Saudi Arabia in term for their pricing in terms of maybe investing in the IPO. So there's some other kind of deals that are going to go into that. But if this is successful, yes, it will help change the narrative a little bit at the margin, but it's not going to be a sudden shift.
Let's move on to fixed income, because there's been so much recent activity with some really big names, Jeff Gundlach, Bill Gross, making statements to the effect that, okay, look, the 35-year bond bull market is over. It's done. In some cases, we've got people, Bill Gross, very outspoken in saying, okay, we're about to see rates seriously start to back up dramatically. What's your view? Is the 35-year bond bull market really over? Are we about to see a big backup in rates, or is this just a little blip we're seeing right now?
So I think the 30-year bond bull market ended a year or so ago. I don't think that suddenly means we need to go into a bear market. I think that I'm absolutely not a bond bear, and I think we can kind of stay in this slightly volatile range for a long time to come. And I'll even go further and say that, you know what, I don't think long-end yields in developed functioning societies, developed functioning markets, are rising substantially for many years to come. So I don't think we're going to see much higher yields at the back end of the curve. We can see tick-ups and they'll kind of move back and forth, but to me there are structural disinflationary pressures which are still underestimated in the market, particularly from technology, but also from demographics. But we're kind of seeing a real change, like commodities, the whole extraction production of commodities is becoming significantly cheaper. That's making things much easier. Transportation, distribution of those goods is becoming more efficient all the time. So I think we're seeing these kind of structural disinflationary pressures. And like one way you can see that is that agricultural prices globally continue to kind of fall to the lowest levels kind of in the last 25 years. And we don't really have great data going back before then. And that's falling to the lowest levels in dollar terms, which, as we've discussed, the dollar is weakening. In local currency terms, they're also plummeting. And when you look at agricultural prices or food prices, this has become really important for the CPI basket, in particularly in Asia, but in a lot of emerging markets, in a lot of countries, but it's very much emphasized in Asia. So it's very hard to get sustained inflation, consumer price inflation in Asia, when you've got food prices that continue to get lower and lower, and they probably will continue to get lower. Food price production is still very inefficient in many parts of the world, and it's getting much more efficient very rapidly. And as energy prices in a much more secular basis have come lower, as we're seeing viable alternatives to oil come through, this is going to continue this kind of trend. So I think because you can't get inflation sustainably accelerating in Asia, that's also the kind of the factory for the world. It's where 40% or more than 40% of the world's population lives. It's where all the growth is. That means it doesn't feed through to inflation elsewhere. So I don't think that we're going to get a sustained inflation in any country, real inflation. So the only way you're going to get like mass inflation is where you get big currency devaluation, but that's not real inflation. That's kind of FX driven. And therefore, I don't think we're going to get much higher rates in the back end. So to put this some kind of perspective is like, you know, 10-year yields, can we see 2.8% at some point this year? Sure. Can we see, you know, even 3%? Maybe. But I don't think we're going to get yields kind of staying above 3% in the 10-year basis in the U.S. anytime soon, unless people start genuinely kind of doubting the U.S.'s ability to repay its debt and they start worrying about its deficit. And I really don't think we're anywhere near that process. So I would say that I'm definitely not a bond bear. I don't think it's an exciting time to be bullish bonds, but I think we're going to be in a range. And I would say that whenever kind of yields spike up, I don't think those spikes in yields will be sustainable. So every time you get this excitement like we had already in January, where bond yields go up to the highs and everyone goes, yes, it's the start of the bear market, and wheel out all the usual names to cite this, I think that's normally a great chance that the market's probably going to reverse pretty soon.
I definitely want to come back to energy, food, and inflation that you just mentioned. But first, before we move off of bond rates, when you say a long time, help me understand what you mean by that. Are we talking about a turning Japanese scenario where we're potentially looking at decades of stagnation and very low yields? And what's driving it? Is it the Lacey Hunt view that there's just too much private debt and that that forces rates to stay low for a long time? Or is it something else? And how long is a long time?
Okay, there's a combination of those things. I'd say, first of all, I would say, like to kind of challenge one perception, this idea that low inflation means stagnation. I think, you know, in the last few years, we've had great examples of some of the fastest growing economies in the world have had massive deflation. And that's like Romania, Israel, Poland are like three great examples in the emerging markets where they had real proper deflation and yet very solid growth. And I think there is this idea that we've built into kind of an economics framework that we all learned in university that, you know what, we need to have 2% inflation because that's good. You know what, that's an arbitrary number. It's not necessary. And even in Japan, it's sometimes mistaken. I'm not saying that Japan economically has been a massive success, but I think sometimes its stagnation, so-called, it is perhaps overhyped. You've got to remember the Japanese economy is shrinking. So if, you know, if they maintain steady GDP and they have a shrinking economy, well, then the GDP per capita is going up. So I don't think the Japanese situation has been as bad as people think. But that said, I don't actually think we're going to go to as low as Japan. I do think that this can last for a number of years. And there's two different parts to this. I think structurally that I don't think for a number of years, I cannot see in the foreseeable 4 or 5 year horizon much higher long end yields in these developed markets. But I also think there's a cyclical thing as well in terms of that we're still in the midst of the positive part of the U.S. economic cycle, in which case the curve tends to continue to flatten. And this happens in kind of every economic cycle in the last 30 years. It's quite standard. We shouldn't be worried by the flattening. This tends to happen towards as we go into the latter half of the cycle. The 2-10s curve in the U.S. still has roughly 50 basis points to flatten, but it should flatten. It should probably invert, and I expect that to happen. It does look like the Fed is very determined to hike rates, so I think that means we will see, you know, front-end yields go higher, and we'll see the long-end yields probably stay roughly where they are or maybe come a bit lower at some point if people worried the Fed has made a mistake. So I think that cyclically, I think there's also downward pressure in long-end yields as the front end is hiking and as we continue this kind of flattening cycle. But I think structurally, there's just no reason for those long end yields to go that high unless people genuinely start challenging the whole economic situation in the US, the whole debt situation. And that's because there's just infinite liquidity in the world. The amount of money that's been pumped into the system since the crisis is just incredibly unbelievable. And I think that people took a long time to adjust to this. I know myself, I took a long time to adjust to this. I was someone who was a super bear going into the crisis. I stayed a super bear for way too long. As someone who was extremely bearish going into the crisis in 2008, I stayed bearish until about 2010, or late 2010, way after we saw the low in asset prices, as I just completely failed to understand the scale of money that was being pumped into the system and what that really meant for financial assets. And I think what that means now is that there's still this massive hangover liquidity in the system. I think people are overly focused on the Fed slightly reducing their balance sheet, but the Fed hasn't been the marginal driver of liquidity for a number of years. In fact, the Fed balance sheet peaked out in late 2014. It's been roughly stable for the last 3 and a bit years. The marginal liquidity from the last few years has been coming from other central banks. The Fed doesn't even have the largest central bank in the world anymore. Three other central banks have much bigger balance sheets. So we've got the PBOC, the ECB, and the BOJ all have larger balance sheets than the Fed now, all continue to pump liquidity into the system. And therefore, that completely dominates any marginal tapering at the from the Fed. Now, this might change at some point in the future. But at the moment, the facts are there is so much liquidity still in the system and so much liquidity still being pumped into the system. And that's why I think that it's very hard for yields to back up, because this money needs to go somewhere. It needs to be parked somewhere. It needs to chase some return. So I think any time that you get a spike in yields, then this money just wants to flow into that system. And that's why I don't think that we'll see sustainably higher yields, much higher yields, in any developed market economy for the next number of years, unless we completely change what Fed central bank balance sheets are doing, unless they massively reduce them. And I just don't see the whole world as one, seeing all central banks reduce their balance sheets in one go, because that would just be complete carnage.
Let's move on to something that you and I have in common, Mark. You and I have both been publicly somewhat outspoken, saying that we think that the massive rally that we've seen in crude oil probably is not sustainable. We also share in common that we've both been wrong so far about that. Are we finally going to be proven right? Is this oil rally almost over, or have we missed the point? And are the people who are saying $80 to $100 going to be proven right?
I'm torn on this one. Like any time where you're getting a market wrong, it kind of lowers your conviction, your confidence. And this is definitely a call I have got wrong. I wrote a couple of years ago that I didn't think we'd see oil prices rising sustainably ever again. I thought we'd see spikes when we saw Middle East tension. I thought there'd be various reasons for supply spikes. And I thought they could be very large spikes. But I kind of thought they'd be the thing that would last for a month or so, and then we'd see prices come down. Instead, we've just seen oil continue to trend higher. And definitely this is taken by surprise. I think, though, that it's not a permanent change of situation. One of the things that's driving the markets at the moment, and I didn't really pick up on this into December so much, is that, you know, importantly for oil markets, speculators can actually dominate the price action for such a long period of time. And at the moment, we still have this backwardation in the oil curve, which means it rewards speculators for being long oil. And so a lot of people look at the market and go, oh my God, speculative positioning in oil is just completely stretched. It's crazy. There's due a massive correction. And people were saying this from a couple of months ago, and yet it continues to motor higher. And that's because, you know what, these speculators are getting paid to hold this position. So even if it falls back a little bit, they're not too worried. And that means it's a very comfortable position. That will change at some point. And also, we will start getting more and more production coming out, particularly in the US, where we have seen the rig count start to pick up again, start to accelerate again. And you know that, well, that will start changing the game. But on top of that, the higher oil prices go, the more incentive there is for OPEC members to cheat on their production as well. So I don't think that this is going to continue going ad infinitum. I don't think we're in a new paradigm of $80 to $100 oil or anything like that. I do think that oil prices will come back lower from where they are now, quite a bit lower, but I'm just not sure it's going to happen in the next couple of weeks. And I do think that the large shift we've seen is going to play into a lot of other themes we've talked about in the world. Oil, I mean, while again, like the dollar's role, the oil's role in asset prices is slowly declining at the margin, but yet at the moment, it remains one of the most important assets to feed into other prices.
Now, you mentioned food a little bit earlier. I want to come back to the subject of commodities in general, particularly agricultural commodities and other softs for that matter. You know, there's been a multi-year secular decline here. Looks like maybe we've put in a bottom and stuff's starting to take off as the dollar has turned south. Is the bottom in for commodities, particularly eggs? And in general, what do you see happening in terms of the map forward from here?
I think, you know, first of all, it's important that you kind of be aware of the dollar lens of looking at this. So I think in terms of dollar prices, which is what the core pricing of all these commodities is, are, I think we have seen commodities bottom out. And I think, you know, oil is driving that at the moment. Metals are kind of doing pretty well and agricultures are very soft. In local currency terms or other currency terms, the picture is less clear. But I do think that there's a broad base in commodities. And that's because global growth is very good and we are seeing a genuine demand pickup, a real demand pickup for a lot of these commodities, particularly in the metal space. And I think that's very positive. So metals, I think that the whole picture is much more tactical. I think even for a couple of month basis, you do see that a lot of the Asian speculation can drive really strong momentum moves. And it's hard to hold on to structural views. So I'd say in metals, my views aren't too exciting in terms that I'm overall relatively constructive. But I find it hard to get excited because I'm just not close enough to the kind of the market of a wit shifting way over any short-term period. And when I say short-term now, I mean over any 1 month to 3 month period. I do think, as I said, oil prices at the moment are still doing well, and I don't think they're going to turn around on an imminent basis, but I don't think they're going to stay high. And I think that will come lower, and I think that will support the global economy. It is good for the global economy to have cheaper energy prices. It just is not good if it happens too quickly. As for food prices, they've just fallen so far over the last couple of years. You have to kind of believe that at some point there's going to be a correction. You know, it's hard for assets to move in a straight line forever. So you do think that there'll be a corrective bounce higher and food prices might have a sudden shift where we kind of get this transition wrong. But I will say that on a secular basis, I do think that food prices will continue to come lower. I think what's happening in the whole food production process you know, just on the science background here, is just unbelievable in terms of how much more efficient we're making kind of our crop yields and our whole process, and also the whole dynamics around diet. And, you know, we're soon going to get into the whole world of lab-grown food. If we do get into that, if we start getting into a world where we kind of get lab-grown food is made cheaply enough, where it's kind of healthier than natural meat, it tastes as good, no one can tell the difference in price, and it's cheaper, well, then it'll suddenly be very hard for much of the world to justify growing billions of animals each year purely for the purposes of slaughtering to eat them. And I say this as someone who loves my burgers, but I think this is going to be a massive shift in the years ahead, which is going to change things. And then that suddenly frees up a lot of agricultural land. As we know, a lot of crops are grown specifically to feed animals, so that goes into the food production process. So I think that at the moment, we're in a secular change in terms of crop production, but this might last long enough to then feed into the whole process of kind of lab-grown meat and change our whole kind of mentality and approach towards food. And I think this is a really, really big background shift over the next 10 years, which is possibly being underestimated in markets, because it has implications for land prices, it has implications for pharmaceutical companies, it has implications for retail, it has implications for food processing, for distribution, for everything. And it's a really big story, but it's probably a bit too slow moving to affect markets in the next couple of years.
Moving on to equities, I should mention that we taped the interview a couple of days early this week because of your location. So we're speaking Tuesday evening, and we've just had the first 1% down day in the S&P that anybody can remember. I guess we had almost that on December 29th. But if finally we're seeing some weakness, and of course already some people are saying, okay, finally it's here. The moment is upon us. The end is nigh. Others are saying, no, this is less than 1%. It's just a blip. Are we seeing the beginning of something here, and what's your outlook for equities, both in the United States and globally?
I think all of us are hoping that we're seeing the beginning of some volatility, at least, which makes it easier for people who trade in markets and for comment in markets, and makes it more kind of interesting dynamics. We can play different themes rather than just sitting long equities and doing nothing else. I will say I don't think it's the start of something new in terms of a structural trend for markets. I remain structurally very bullish, and something I kind of repeat, and you know, on Bloomberg TV, I kind of probably bore a lot of the viewers. A regular rant of mine is that there are three pillars behind this structural global bull market in equities, and that is growth, earnings, and liquidity. And until one of them crumbles, I think you've got to stay kind of bullish overall. This doesn't mean we can't get more volatility, and it would make sense that we're going to get much more volatility, but this is just the structural picture, that this doesn't look like this is the peak and the turn, and you should turn bearish. And I think that's kind of very important. Global growth is very good. The simple average G10 growth rate forecast for 2018 is close to 2.2%. That was only put at, you know, around 2% in September, or below 2%. And so there are broad upward revisions happening in the developed world. The US is accelerating, expected to accelerate to 2.6% this year from 2.3% the year before. China may be slowing, but it's still above 6%, which is really quite phenomenal given the size of the economy. Asia overall is growing exceptionally well. As we discussed earlier, liquidity is still absolutely abundant in the system. Just because the Fed is reducing its balance sheet doesn't matter, because the rest of the world is still pumping money into the system. And that's helped the margin. That trend has helped the margin by the fact that we're getting a weaker dollar, which is kind of emphasizing the liquidity being added by those central banks, while it's also diminishing the effect of the Fed's central bank balance sheet reduction. And finally, you know, earnings are still good. Global earnings were phenomenal in 2017. That's not going to be repeated everywhere in 2018. But the tax reform in the US has provided a new boost to earnings, certainly in the US. And that makes a big kind of, it's an important indicator, because it reflects sentiment everywhere, it influences sentiment everywhere. And we can kind of debate whether the tax reform will be brilliant for the economy or not, or will it much be a game changer for the economy. I am in the camp that I'm slightly cynical that it'll be that great for growth, but it is a game changer for equities, because it will massively boost earnings. And that suddenly makes all the ratios look more attractive again. So I think overall the story for earnings, liquidity, and growth remains strong, and therefore you've got to be structurally bullish. It's really, really important to emphasize this doesn't mean we can't get more liquidity. Just because we've had such a sustained period with more volatility, just because we've had such a sustained period of no volatility doesn't mean that that's going to go on forever. In fact, it makes it more likely we get increased volatility, because traders have to take more risk to fill up VAR limits, value at risk limits, which means they're more leveraged, which means they're more vulnerable to a bit of a shock. But ultimately, the structural bull story still remains.
I want to move on to China because I know that's right in your backyard, and I'm very much looking forward to getting your view since you're in Asia. A lot of people, a lot of analysts have a lot of concern about China. Kyle Bass in particular has been very outspoken with this view, saying that the credit expansion that has occurred in China is just so massive that when that unwinds, it potentially is going to create a credit crisis that forces the PBOC, whether they want to or not, to dramatically devalue the yuan. That could send a wave of deflation around the world. There are concerns that if there was a major problem in China's economy, there would be knock-on effects to Australia in particular. 47% of Australian GDP, of course, is exports to China. You're actually there. A lot of these analysts who talk about these views on Bloomberg Television have never been to China. You have. What's your take on the whole China story? Are these risks as real as people have talked about?
So the risks are very real, but I would say that I'm generally very constructive on China. I'm generally very bullish on China as a broad thing. So I think let's address the two parts of what you said there that I think that are completely valid. The risks are terms are real in terms of the impact. If there is a big problem in China, the knock-on effects are going to be massive. China is the marginal consumer of many commodities in the world. It's the marginal demand consumer for most countries' exports now in the world. It's not the U.S. The change in kind of demand comes from China. So many economies are dependent on what China does. And if China growth takes a big shock, it's going to be catastrophic for markets. So I think that is real. The next bit that I also agree with is that the corporate debt bubble is massive. It is unprecedented. It is scary. Now, that is the end of where I agree. I think there are so many times where this analysis of China is just really poor, and it's by lots of people who have never been to China, don't understand it. And one of the things is this corporate debt bubble is that it's very much looked at in isolation rather than looking at kind of China Inc. as a whole. So importantly, that China private savings rates are exceptionally high. People look at the property bubble. Again, it's the analysis is terrible. People used to talk a few years ago about the ghost cities in China, not understanding the culture of how it was built, where people would actually buy their apartments before all the infrastructure was in because there was such a boom in property and they knew there was so much demand there. So people would buy these property kind of off plan. There was no infrastructure. So all these Western analysts would kind of go in and go, oh my God, all these properties are owned, but no one's living there. What they didn't realize is if they went back 2 years later, they'd suddenly go to a city with 6 million people there. The rate of urbanization is just incredible. There's also a culture in China that newly married couples tend to try wanting to move into a new house or apartment that no one else has lived in before. And that means if you buy an apartment and keep it empty and don't have a rental yield, it retains a massive value, a value premium above apartments where you're getting a rental yield, which means it's not such a problem for saving money by buying property that stays empty. And I think a lot of these cultural things are misunderstood in the Western world. On top of that, the deposit to loan ratio in China for buying property is much higher in the West. So the property market is much less vulnerable. Private savings rates are very high. Banks tend to be very well capitalized. And then, of course, you've got the government. I mean, China has more than $3 trillion FX reserves. Let's imagine that there's $1 trillion in bad debt in China. You know what? They don't have a Congress. They are a single-party system. I'm not saying it'd be completely smooth, but relatively easy. They could set up a bad bank tomorrow with $1 trillion in bad debt, wipe out all the bad debt, and suddenly China has no more corporate bad debt left, and they still have the largest FX reserves pile in the world. China Inc. overall is exceptionally wealthy. So I think where I get really upset is a lot of these analysts who've never been to China don't understand. They look at it through purely the kind of the Western, the U.S. economic framework, the U.S. economic model, which is not what applies here. And they don't look at both the assets and the liabilities. They don't look at the whole balance sheet, which is very important. Now, I am slightly simplifying the situation. This is to make the bigger picture that I am not very worried about China's debt problem on a global economic basis. We all know that if that happens, there's going to be some financial market disruption. And if the corporate debt bubble does start having problems, you know, there'll be a slight delay before they can solve problems. All I'm saying is that the Chinese economic and political system makes it much easier for them to solve these problems quicker than it can happen in the West. And they've got much better resources. So they will be solved. It's not like the corporate debt bubble will be allowed to just collapse in like some complete mess. So I'm not really worried about China for many years to come. If the corporate debt bubble continues to kind of grow at a faster pace that they're kind of catching up with the economy, then it's continuing to be a worry. But it's not something I'm worried about for like many years to come. So overall, I'm very constructive China. And I think this is one of the reasons why for the last number of years, I've probably been much more bullish than the average analyst out there. Part of the reason I'm super positive financial assets, that if China is doing much better than people think, well, then there's probably some premium on the upside that people are missing.
Let's move on to Europe next. We've had guests on this program with views ranging from, okay, Brexit was the beginning of the end, it's all over, European exit contagion is going to be the whole theme of macro for the next two decades, the European Union is toast, it's over, it's done. And we've had at the opposite extreme, people just say, look, Brexit was a flash in the pan, it was a little bit of a political anomaly that you should just forget about and ignore. What is your view on Europe, the structural problems that some people exist there, how bad are they, or do they exist at all? And particularly, the euro has been very strong recently. Is that going to continue? And where do you see the euro headed longer term?
So over the last 15 years, I've actually been at both sides of that kind of spectrum. I was someone who believed that the euro currency wouldn't survive the first major crisis. So when the financial crisis came, I thought that was it. It was certainly a matter of time. And I was someone who, in 2010, 2011, we had the Greek crisis, who was convinced that it might take a couple of years, but it was just a matter of time and that the euro would not last. Clearly, I was completely wrong in that. And I think as part of being wrong, I realized that there's some things that I missed. And one of that is that the political will in Europe is probably much stronger than is realized. Again, particularly I think in the US, they underestimate the political will around this project. And I think it's important that now that the Eurozone has survived not just a small recession, not just a small crisis, but a pretty massive financial crisis. And, you know, at its early stage of its creation, it has made it so much stronger. There wasn't the structure in place there to survive a lot of these problems. But, you know, they kept on sticking on more and more band-aids to solve these problems. And eventually they've actually put quite a robust structure in place there that overall Eurozone will continue to survive, you know, problems. It's much more resilient now than as a construct than it was 7 or 8 years ago. So I think I've gone from somebody who thinks that euro was vulnerable, was going to fall in any crisis, to as of about 2 years ago, I am now, look, all European political risks are completely overhyped. And that was very much the view I had last year in France, and I've been very bullish the euro. I think that theme probably has a little bit more to run, but I think it's running out of steam. The reason I think it has a little bit more to run is people are getting excited about the Italian election again. But again, for the euro, for the currency, it's irrelevant. The Italian election is not a big risk. It might be a small risk for some domestic assets, Italian bonds, but it's not a concern. It's not an existential concern for the euro currency. And I think that's very important. And that's the dynamic that changed probably a couple of years ago. I probably only realized it myself maybe 14 months ago, and that was kind of going into the European elections last year. So I think overall, there is this kind of, the world is structurally underinvested in European assets. FX reserves managers have been underweight euro as they've had this kind of worry, and we've kind of seen that correction. So I think that overall the euro story is still good, but it's running out of steam. It's kind of on its last legs, and that's because the whole speculative market has got very excited by Europe, and I think they may be getting a bit ahead of themselves. And it's kind of like this whole situation that I discussed earlier with the dollar having front run the Fed rate hikes. There's a lot of the market that are front running the fact that the euro might taper a bit earlier because growth is good, and then when it finally happens, when we start getting the reduction of, the change in negative rate policy in euro, there's probably less of a boost left in the euro currency. So the overall summary is that I think the euro is still probably has a little bit more upside, but I think we're in the last legs of that story, and I'm no longer excited by the story. I think there's better, more exciting things to play in this world.
So it sounds like you think the story is a good one. It's just a little overplayed and perhaps about to run out of steam. Does that mean we're just setting up for a correction and then a resumption of a secular trend of strength in the euro? Or is it over and done with and time to move on to the next trade, not just in a tactical sense, but in a secular sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess when you get to the late stage of any kind of theme or narrative, you do tend to get more volatility. So I think that we've entered a time in the next kind of few months where we're going to start getting a bit more tactical, a bit more volatility in euro. And I think that means for a lot of macro investors, it becomes something less interesting to trade at. I think the best stories are where you've got both the kind of the long-term macro story fits the tactical story. So for example, the dollar last year was a perfect example. To me, it was one of the best ones in FX in years, in terms of that the structural fundamental story was very negative, the dollar, and it had become much more negative, the dollar, in late 2016, and yet the tactical situation was also very negative, dollar, because the whole world was so bullish. What you've got in Europe now is that the structural fundamental story is now less exciting. You know, the euro is appreciated so much that there's probably less upside. So again, it's not that it's negative, but it's just a bit not too exciting. And also tactically, people are super bulled up, and that means there's going to be more volatility. So I think it's probably just that there's much easier things to kind of look at in terms of expected return relative to expected volatility.
Let's move on to emerging markets. I'm guessing, given your dollar views longer term, you're probably bullish on emerging markets. Tell us what the outlook is there.
Yeah, look, I'm super bullish emerging markets on a long-term basis. I think, first of all, yeah, I'm particularly bullish emerging markets. I'm particularly bullish Asia. I think when you look at kind of where the growth is in the world, where the exciting stories, I mean, again, in 2018, where are all the fastest growing countries in the world going to be? They're going to be in Asia. It's going to be India, Philippines, China, Indonesia, Malaysia. All these countries will have above 5% growth. Demographics, not just in terms of size of population. I mean, India, China, Indonesia alone, just those three countries make up 40% of the world's population. India and China, you know, make up more than 30% of that. But also the age of the population in many of them, not as much in China, but in many of the other countries, like whether it's India, Philippines, Indonesia, is just so much more positive demographics. So I think that the structural story is you've got better growth, you've got better demographics, and these things essentially are cheap. Now, I say cheap in kind of two ways, in terms of that there was this massive correction in emerging markets post-crisis. And that still hasn't kind of fully caught up, even though we've got much better growth there. There's still kind of a big discount for emerging markets, a long-term discount for emerging markets. And I know it's played a massive part to catch up in the last year, and I'll reiterate what I said earlier, just because there's a secular change doesn't mean we can't get more volatility in that theme. But I think overall that's got a lot to kind of play out. But importantly, I think for these macro stories, currencies always come back to being one of the most important. If your currency can do well, then that kind of feeds through to a lot of other assets, and it kind of helps the whole story. And a lot of these EM currencies are still massively undervalued on a PPP basis. Now, I know many of your listeners will correctly say that, look, PPP, purchasing power parity, is irrelevant for kind of trading over a short term. Absolutely, it is irrelevant over a short term. People like using RERs, real effective exchange rates, but the problem with RERs is they tend to start, well, they have to start on an arbitrary basis. I prefer PPPs because they're completely objective. There's no subjectivity in them. And over a much longer-term macro basis, which is what I tend to kind of look at, they are relevant and they do kind of play into factors. And the fact is that many of these emerging market currencies are just so undervalued. Many of these Asian ones we're talking about are 60% undervalued to the dollar on a PPP basis. Now, they shouldn't be equal to the dollar. There should be a dollar premium, but it shouldn't be that large. So these are going to continue to support their economies, and a lot of them are doing structural reform at the margin at different paces, and there's awkward process. But the multi-year story here for emerging markets is just so positive, and particularly in Asia.
Mark, we've touched on so many different macro topics all around the world. Pulling this all together, how do you think about markets going forward? How do you pull this all together into an investing framework?
So I think that, very importantly, I come from a quite a quant background. My degree was mathematics and economics, and I kind of like looking at the data. But something I realized over trading over years is that markets actually trade much more off narratives. And I think the best example of that is when you get a GDP print. So sometime in Q1, we'll get a GDP print for Q4 in the US, and markets will react in seconds to a number that's giving data for several months ago. And I think the fact is, you even ask many traders out there, when they react to a retail sales number or an industrial production number, and you go, for what month was that data from? And they won't even know, 2 months previous or 1 month previous or what month it is. And that's because markets actually trade around narratives. Now, where I think markets get really interesting is when you get a massive dislocation between fundamentals and narratives. And the dollar last year was a great example of that. And I think this is how I look at markets. So I spend my whole time kind of looking at data, looking at fundamentals. I'm a very much a spreadsheet-based person comparing stuff. And what I look for is when that there's a sign that the narrative out there is very dislocated from markets. So that's what I continue to look at this year. And I think that's it's always going to be the driver of markets. And it's part of the reason why I've come to Bloomberg. Why not help shape the narrative rather than being suffered to wait till everyone else changes it?
Fantastic. Mark, I can't thank you enough for an excellent interview. Now, for listeners that would like to follow more of your work, for our professional audience that has access to the Bloomberg Terminal, you've got just a huge amount of writing that's available there. Unfortunately for our retail audience, Mark's writing is only available on the Bloomberg Terminal platform, which is institutionally priced. For the benefit of those who are fortunate to have access to it, what should they do in order to find your numerous writings there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the main kind of product that I run in Asia is the Markets Live blog. So MLIV is the function on Bloomberg Terminal. And that's a 24 hours a day, 5 days a week kind of live market commentary. And rather than kind of breaking news, which Bloomberg does very well elsewhere, what we try to do is be the first kind of people to provide analysis. And we kind of, we've got the massive resources of Bloomberg, but we've kind of got a dedicated team, mostly of kind of ex-traders and strategists who are kind of focused on trying to provide the immediate analysis with no agenda. And I think that's probably the most exciting place to watch. I also write some macro review, and we as a team have done some kind of large 2018 macro outlook pieces across a number of assets that we've discussed today.
Fantastic. I cannot thank you enough for an excellent interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, what a great interview with Mark Cudmore. It was great to have him on the show. I just found it really interesting, his views on China. But, you know, I wanted to give a little bit of a pushback because, you know, when I listen to Kyle Bass or any of these, I don't want to speak for Kyle, but, you know, when we listen to these guys talking about China, I don't think any of them are really long-term bearish China. I think everyone generally accepts that over the long-term, China is going to be relatively bullish and it's going to be just fine. In fact, they have probably more flexibility from a monetary and fiscal policy than any other country in the developed nations, right? And so I don't think that that's really a point of contention. The real issue is the credit expansion that has occurred. And, you know, Mark admitted to it, saying that there's this big massive expansion in corporate debt and all the other credit issuance in there. And, you know, to me, I still think that there's a chance that there's going to be, whether you want to call it a business cycle, a credit cycle, something that's going to have to let the air out of the balloon in terms of all of this credit that was created and allow all of those non-performing loans and other things to be cleaned out of the system. That's the normal cyclicality of these cycles. You know, and a lot of people, you know, look at that China situation and they say, well, look, in China, you have a situation where the PBOC or the government is going to come out and bail out the system. They're not going to let something bad happen. So I want to rewind back to 2015. So back in 2015, China was going through a huge stock market bubble. The China A50 was just ripping higher. In June of 2015, we saw their peak, and the China stock market proceeded to wipe out almost 50% of its value to the downside, going from over 15,000 on the upside down to 8,000 on the downside. The first down sequence lasted just 3 months, wiping out that downside, but it spent two quarters, basically 6 months in the gutter on the downside before things recovered. And so there was a cycle. Where was the PBOC to bail out the stock market? Where was the Chinese government to bail it out? In the end, China went through an excess and a correction that followed. But what was interesting about that is that when China was going through that correction, it was in August of 2015 that the US equity markets experienced the flash crash on the downside. And it was in January of 2016 that the US stock markets had another very big correction in unison with the correction in China. So there's this contagion effect that comes from there. And everyone believing that somehow, you know, China and the PBOC will be able to insulate the economy and prevent even from a short-term blip, I just don't think so. I think there's going to be still something that, that without being long-term bearish on China, there's going to be some sort of event that still happens. And when China sneezes, maybe the rest of the world catches a cold. What did you take away from that interview?
Well, just to react to what you said, you know, another point that Mark made, and I know this from my own experience living in Hong Kong and having spent a lot of time researching this whole ghost city situation in China. You know, so many American investors, they look from afar and they say, holy cow, all of these vacant properties. They can't find tenants for any of these things. It's a disaster over there. It's a bloodbath waiting to happen. And that was certainly the way it seemed to me until I talked to people with boots on the ground experience who said, no, dude, you don't get it. It's a different culture. Nobody is having trouble finding tenants for their rental properties. They're not interested in renting. What they do is they buy real estate as a store of value and they sit on it. It's a cultural thing. It's just the Chinese way of doing things. They place such a high premium on real estate being new that nobody's ever lived in it before that they're not interested in buying an investment property and renting it. They buy an investment property and sit on it and let it stay empty because in Chinese culture, that's the way they do things. So they're not having trouble finding tenants. They don't want tenants. It's a different equation. And what's happening is American investors that are used to the American paradigm of a low rental occupancy rate equals crisis going on right now. It doesn't equal that. It's people who don't have any interest in renting their properties, buying them as a store of value, and sitting on them. It's not what we thought. So the question is this another situation where you look at this and it seems to us like the credit expansion that's happened in China is insane. It has to blow up and it has to end very badly. Or is it another situation like that where we're just looking at it through the wrong lens and we don't understand that culturally it's a different game? I don't know. Now, Kyle Bass is the guy who got the U.S. housing situation right and saw that that was a ticking time bomb that was going to blow up and knew to bet big on it and got it right. That's how Kyle became such a famous guy. He is absolutely convinced that that's about to happen in terms of a massive credit event happening to China. Is he right because he's a smart guy, or is he missing something because it's a different culture and we don't quite understand how things work? I don't know, but that's the question. It's beyond my pay grade, but I think it is important to understand things work differently there. It's not something where you can take your knowledge of U.S. markets and apply it and assume that things are going to be the same.
All right. Well, Eric, you know, we promised all our listeners to get to the ratio call spread and talk about the S&P 500. But when I was putting together a little chart book, which I wanted to share with all our listeners, by the way, the chart book is available in the Research Roundup email, or those that are registered users can literally on the homepage in the article for Mark Cudmore find the link to view it. And I added two additional charts, which I wanted to first talk about in oil, because I was reading the Bank of Canada monetary policy report for January that just came out as Bank of Canada raised rates another 25 basis points. And on inside the monetary policy report, they had two oil charts. And when I saw them, I said, I got to get Eric's opinion on this. I want to sort of understand like what's going on and what you think the impacts are. So pages one and two of that chart book, I shared these charts. And so the first chart is looking at U.S. oil production, which has been picking up steadily since 2016. And what shocked me over here when looking at this chart is that U.S. oil production in terms of millions of barrels a day appears to have reached the same peak level as it was in 2014 and 2015, where oil was trading well over $100 a barrel. What's going on this chart?
Well, we are seeing an increase in U.S. production, and I think that's set to continue for sure. As you know, shale responds to increasing prices, and they've done a lot of hedging. I expect the rig count to pick up in coming weeks, and we are going to see more U.S. production. It is important to note that these two lines are on a different scale here, so there's a little bit of a distortion in the sense that the size of the move on the blue line and the size of the move on the brown line are measured on different scales. But I think that at the end of the day, what's going to happen is there's going to be more production in the U.S. There is not, I don't think, going to be a dramatic reduction from here in OPEC. And I think that this this whole narrative that you're hearing about energy prices are, you know, above 70 for the rest of forever, and, you know, we're on our healthfully on our way in a new rally to $100 plus oil prices. I just don't see it, Patrick. Now, I do think that that and a lot more than that is coming, but well down the road. What's happened here is you've had the shale revolution was really several different shale plays, the Bakken, the Permian Basin, the Eagleford, the Haynesville, all these different shale plays. Basically, when we had the big sell-off in 2014, the Permian continued to be economic. All the others were too expensive because it didn't make sense at lower oil prices. Well, now that we're getting up to these oil prices, what happens is the Bakken and the Eagleford come back online. Eventually, though, even if we get to $90, $100 oil prices, we're going to play out shale. We've already drilled the Permian up like Swiss cheese, and a lot of people think the Permian is almost spent in terms of all the sweet spots have been used. There's not a lot more shale oil to get. I mean, certainly there's big reserves that are in the ground, but in terms of economically producing it, it's probably got close to as far as it's going to go. We've got a bit more to go. Once the Bakken and the Eagle Ford start to get economic again, we're going to produce those. At some point, though, shale has played out. The countryside has been drilled up like Swiss cheese. There's no more shale plays to be had, and we've got to go back to deep water offshore in order to meet marginal demand. When that happens, and I think it's still 2 or 3 years off before we get to that point, that's when all of a sudden, you know, those big rigs have been rusting and they've not been maintained. And there's a whole bunch of CapEx that hasn't happened yet that needs to happen in order to ramp up the ability to meet the world's oil need with deep water offshore. When we get to that point, we're looking at much higher oil prices. But, you know, I think that as we get to the prices we've already got, and we could go back down south from here a little bit, you've got oil prices high enough to get the Bakken and the Eagle Ford back online. And I think that drilling activity is going to increase U.S. production considerably. Eventually, that's going to play out, but we're not there yet.
All right. Well, listen, the second chart, which I wanted your comment, because I agree with you. I think actually there's going to be the supply, and it's going to kind of, at least the interim period, probably suppress further rises in oil. But I mean, that's just my speculation. But the second chart I thought was really interesting, and if you can just quickly comment before we get on to the credit spreads, is it shows the overlap of Brent oil prices, West Texas Intermediate, and the Western Canadian Select oil prices. And really, Western Canadian Select oil has had its own issues, particular transportation pipelines and all these other things. But what's amazing is how wide the spread has now gotten, probably close to $30 now, between Western Canadian Select oil and that of West Texas Intermediate. And what I'm curious about is, now that all those issues are going to subside at some point, do you think it's more that Western Canadian Select is going to gravitate, is the spread going to narrow with Western going to go higher, or is it going to be West Texas coming down towards where Western Canadians currently trading?
Patrick, as I understand this issue with Western Canada Select, it's all about logistics. It's not that anybody doesn't approve of that oil or thinks it's no good or doesn't want it. It's stuck in Canada, and the Keystone Pipeline, the existing Keystone Pipeline, they're already pedaling as fast as they can. And look at the drawdowns that are occurring in Cushing, Oklahoma. It's not because they're not trying to send more oil down from Canada. It's because they can't. And I think that certainly this problem with the West Canada Select spread being so wide, someday when you get the Keystone XL pipeline fully approved and built and turns operational, that would come right out because you'd have plenty of pipeline capacity to deal with it. Until then, what's happening is that is a less desirable grade of oil. It's not unusable, but it's not as good as some of the other oil. What they're going to do is they're going to pipe the good stuff down to the States, and there's not enough pipes to carry the remaining stuff. And as I understand it, that's the issue there. I don't know how long that can continue. I think that if you look at the trend, though, that we've been seeing with U.S. exports now being legalized and the trend in exports, we're seeing that Cushing is continuing. This week, Cushing drew down 4.2 million barrels. That's utterly massive. They're already running that pipeline from Canada, the Keystone Pipeline that already exists, not Keystone XL, that's the one that you hear so much about. They're going as fast as they can. So as long as the current price dynamics, the Brent WTI spread stays as wide as it is, and there's an incentive for export, I think that happens. What would solve this? If the Brent WTI spread were to come in or even invert so that the incentive for exporting oil from the U.S. changed, then what might happen is that would reduce the total demand that's going down to Cushing. Now, if the pipelines are not totally saturated with other grades, maybe at that point it comes together. But frankly, it's beyond my pay grade to know exactly what's going to influence that. My understanding, though, is the reason that that divergence is so big is about logistics. But I want to come back to this ratio call spread, Patrick, because we've been getting a huge number of emails about this. We have talked about this before. We don't remember which episode it is, so we don't know how to refer people back to it. So what we talked about doing this week was to try to cover it again now, but you and I talked about this off the air, Patrick, and realized there's so much information there. What makes a lot more sense is you have actually set up a full-length webinar on the subject of the ratio call spread trade. You're going to do that in the same webinar format that you use for your paying clients at bigpicturetrading.com. And of course, for anyone who doesn't know, it's hard to imagine that you wouldn't, but Patrick is in the business of teaching people how to trade. He has courses about options, courses about fundamentals, courses about macro, courses about technical analysis, and so forth. And it's based on an interactive online webinar format that allows people to ask questions and everything. Normally, you have to pay for that. I have persuaded Patrick to do a free one just for Macro Voices listeners on the subject of the ratio call spread trade. So we've got, I think, a few slides anyway, just to give us an overview of what to expect from that webinar, which people can register for free at bigpicturetrading.com. What's in the rest of the slide deck, just to get us warmed up for what we can expect from the webinar?
All right. Well, first of all, what I want to just emphasize is that what makes the ratio call spread really interesting right now, not all market environments are ideal for that kind of a strategy. But what we have is a situation where we have a market that is actually, even in spite of the low implied volatilities, is moving in an accelerated pace. And really, there's going to be very few outcomes. Either the market's going to melt upwards and just keep ripping higher, or we're going to have a pretty solid market correction. The likelihood that the market just kind of reaches its upper plateau and just flatlines for an extended period is unlikely. And so that's what makes the ratio call spread such a unique and interesting strategy for actually trading this exact market environment. I'm going to explain that in the webinar for all those Macro Voice listeners that join me. But what I wanted to do is start off with a chart. It's the third chart in the chart book, which really just demonstrates how we are in this accelerated pace of the market rise. And what I wanted to just do is do a comparison of the slope of the rises. This is a weekly chart of the S&P 500 going back a decade, and you can see that we are now accelerating to the upside, and what is the characteristic of that late stage euphoria phase of a market melt-up. This is where, you know, there's analyst after analyst suggesting we could see 3,000 or even 3,200 or 3,500 on the S&P 500. It's because we're getting in this accelerated phase, and that's why I think this is a really interesting time to consider the strategy. The reason that is that because eventually when you have these parabolic rises, the correction that's on the other side is usually in some degree or another proportional to the prior rise. And therefore, even though we're going to get this big rise, when the market correction eventually kicks in, it's going to be a nasty one. So how do you create a balancing act between the two of how do I continue to participate on the upside and not get caught badly on the other side if the market turns down? And so I wanted to just in some of the other charts show some just really interesting excesses on the markets. On page 4, we have from Morgan Stanley QDS. It was a chart that basically showed the fact that the estimated net demand in S&P 500 futures is pretty much almost at a decade high, north of $30 billion in the most recent rolling 10-day surge. What's interesting on chart 5, they show us the estimated S&P 500 calls held by customers now having gone to the 100th percentile of the last decade. And the amount of now customers that are long S&P 500 call options is now reached 100th percentile. It just shows how excessive or extreme the market is at this stage. And the sixth chart there is showing the reciprocal, which is right now, in spite of the stock market being at its all-time high, and this is the now almost the longest period in the last 30 years without a 5% market correction, the amount of S&P puts held by customers to hedge that downside risk is to the zero percentile. right? So like literally you would think that, you know, as the market gets higher and higher, people would be more inclined to buy protection and loading up on puts as a hedge to the downside. And yet we're at the zero percentile in terms of the last 10 years. So such an interesting chart that way.
Well, you know what they say, Patrick, opportunity knocks when it's least expected. This reminds me of, you know, housing prices never go down. They can only go up. And of course, nobody's worried about hedging risk. We've gotten to the point where the mentality is the stock market can never go down. We don't need any puts. We don't need to hedge any downside risk because it can only go up. That's all that can happen. Usually that's the time when you need to be careful.
No, absolutely. You know, and what I wanted to show just one last chart on the chart 7, what I'm showing here, again, it's provided by Morgan Stanley QDS team. And what it's showing is the normalized put skew in terms of how much premium there is on a put versus a call. Now, one thing that we have talked about on this show going back to like November is we were talking about the lopsided skew, the fact that put options were relatively far more expensive and call options because of the skew were actually really cheap. But what's amazing in the last month or more, what we have seen is this skew completely normalized. We're now seeing the cost of call options on a relative basis becoming much more expensive. We're finally seeing almost this normalization. We're back to levels we saw back in 2012, 2013, 2015 in terms of the premiums. And so that really shows that we went from this period where everyone was hedging and there was a big premium put in puts to now call options are demonstrating a pretty healthy premium versus puts. And so this is why I actually think this is a great time to be using things like combination trades and spreads versus that of just outright buying calls and puts.
So just to summarize this whole picture here, the ratio call spread is a trade that's entirely about giving you a way to participate if there's more upside, if there's a melt up that's still going to continue. You can make money on this trade. Unlike buying calls outright, if the market just rolls over tomorrow and crashes, you don't lose anything because of the structure of this ratio spread. So you only lose money if the market goes up only a little bit from here and then stays flat after that. And we don't think that's likely to happen. So that's the ratio call spread. People who want to learn all about that, it's a free webinar. Normally your webinars are for a fee. For Macro Voices listeners only, it's a free webinar. You go to bigpicturetrading.com, and that's where you can sign up for it. And it's this weekend. There's one on Sunday and one also on Monday for our audience that prefers a weekday time slot. Now, I've got to believe, Patrick, that in addition to this, I'm just thinking this through in my own mind. If you can participate in the upside with the ratio call spread, I've got to believe if you're concerned about the market crashing is another possibility. There's a way to do that with the ratio put spread. And at the same time, I would think that maybe a ratio straddle or something also makes sense if you think it could do either one of those things. The webinar that you're doing for free this weekend is just about the ratio call spread. Now, if people also wanted to learn all these other strategies and how to deploy them, I'm assuming that you have an options course that is for a fee that people can enroll in for that. Do they have to be in Toronto? And if not, can it be done over the internet? And where can they get more information about that?
Well, Eric, you know, the program is not geographically regional. It is an online program. It involves a series of modules that are supported by live trading tutorials, where in the live markets, we apply all the strategies, because that's, you know, one of my firm beliefs is that people don't learn by just watching a video. They want to see it done. And the decisions of how you manage the trade after you're in, when do you take profits? How do you cut a loss? And when do you do it? Those are all the things that happen after you learn the theory of what is the strategy. And those are all things that we cover with all of our students in our program.
Okay, so basically the game plan here is if you're interested in this ratio call spread trade, sign up for the free webinar. It's completely free, costs you nothing. Don't look a free webinar in the mouth, so to speak. If you get hooked on it and you want more and you want to learn all about the other strategies, that is available. That costs a fee, and I'm sure that they can find more information about the cost of those programs at bigpicturetrading.com. So that's the game plan, folks, and I think you'll find that webinar to be very worthwhile. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. The more listeners we have, and particularly the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. So please, if you haven't already, take a minute, just go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It is just a compendium of links to all of the coolest content that we could find each week, including downloads from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, you'll find the transcript for today's interview with Mark Cudmore. You'll also find the link to that chart book that Eric and I discussed in the post game. There's an article also from Jesse Felder titled, "According to These Three Measures, the Stock Market is Now Literally Off the Charts." There's also a great article about Morgan Stanley suggesting that we have now entered the late cycle euphoria stage, which is something we just talked about in the post game. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and follow myself, @PatrickSresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.